you for being a friend. Travel down the road and back again. Your heart is true, you're a pal and a confidant. If you threw a party and invited everyone you knew, you would see the biggest gift would be from me. And the card attached would say, thank you for being a friend.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Beloved Journal. We have a really interesting episode for you today. Today, I'm interviewing Brian Kaler and Beau Underwood, who have recently completed and published a new book, Baptizing America, How Mainline Protestants Help Build Christian Nationalism. It's a fascinating read. I commend it to you all. I have a copy on my shelf. The foreword was written by Adrian Thorne, who is the senior minister at the Riverside Church. And many of the accolades and endorsements for this book are from many different auspicious people from all kinds of different walks of life. But the consistent and resounding message is that we have helped formulate and allow for Christian nationalism to flourish in our country by our action and our inaction. And so Brian and Beau both take us through that in the book and on the podcast. I hope you might take time to listen to this podcast, but to also grab their book and to listen to what they have to say about things. It's a fascinating subject. It's an important subject, and it's one that's going to be even more pressing this year in 2024. So without much further conversation on my part, let's get to the conversation that they offer to us here on Beloved Journal. As always, thanks for listening.
Well, gosh, thank you guys so much for coming on Beloved Journal.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
You know, your book opens with a rather harrowing account of January 6th on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, where a pastor is praying aloud for America to be one nation under God. Yeah, you know, it got me thinking where I was on January 6th. It's one of those dates that kind of lives in your collective memory and individual memory very, very prolifically. It's kind of one of those dates that's seared into your mind. So I'm curious, where were you guys on January 6th and what effect did it have on you as you played witness to those events, both pastorally and prophetically in your lives?
Well, so I'll tell you a little of my story, and particularly related to the conversation of seeing Christian nationalism that day, because I know that was one of the things that surprised a lot of people was the Christian symbols of that day. So an occupational hazard of mine as a journalist is that I go to events of across the spectrum, including those by those pushing Christian nationalism. So I actually went to a couple of Stop the Steal rallies in Jefferson City, Missouri, where I live, the state capital, before January 6th. And the first one I went to, I started noticing the Christian flag, Appeal to Heaven flag, handwritten signs with scripture verses and comments about God. And so I realized that, wow, there's something happening here religiously. And so on the morning of January 6th, I thought, well, I'm going to go back to the one at the state capitol because they were having rallies at state capitals across the country just to check that out a little bit in person and then head home in time to turn on C-SPAN because, you know, we are nerds and we watch C-SPAN and C-SPAN 2. And so I went there that morning and I'm seeing all these symbols again, the Christian flag, crosses, signs about God will drain the swamp and that kind of thing. I take a few pictures and then I go home and turn it on. Of course, then that's when the chaos is just beginning. And so I'm kind of primed. I'm noticing immediately all of the religious symbols also in that violent crowd. And so, yeah, it's definitely one of those days that you remember where you were. And, you know, I started texting my dad and Beau and I are texting and calling and saying, hey, are you watching what's going on?
Yeah. And my experience of January 6th, 2021 was very similar, just being glued to the TV and watching that chaos unfold. But Rob, as you know, the book opens on January 6th with a preacher praying at the Capitol, but it was January 6th, 2022, the 1 year anniversary, where the Speaker of the House, who at the time was Nancy Pelosi, organized an official prayer event. And the speaker was Michael Curry of the Episcopal Church, somebody who I really admire, whose ministry I really appreciate. But he was the only speaker, and he was praying for this to be for us to be one nation under God. And the hymns that were sung that day were Christian hymns. And so to have a sort of officially organized government event to commemorate January 6th, where only Christian voices were heard, helps you to realize that even a lot of the people who would be against Christian nationalism, a lot of the people who would be very critical of what happened on January 6th, 2021, were still kind of perpetuating some of the sins of conflating American and Christian identities in a way that exclude people and in a way that frankly makes the nation into an idol. And so we actually saw that a year later by from people who we really wouldn't have expected to be part of the problem and people who don't want to be part of the problem, but were.
I think that's one of the interesting things that I opened your book and I started to kind of bristle at myself a little bit. Before we get into that though, and of course, mad respect for Bishop Curry, he's been on this podcast. I think the world of him, and I think we all do. But that said, I hope, Bo, you might give me a working definition of what Christian nationalism is, and then Brian, you might add in if you have anything to add.
Yeah, and I really appreciate this question. Whenever we do a presentation, we always want to start with definitions because there's so many things that are tied to this term as it's becoming sort of more used and sometimes used wrongly. So when we talk about Christian nationalism, we're just talking about the conflation of Christian and American identities in a way that by fusing them together seeks to advance a certain, what I call retrograde social order, right? So it's being used to justify a particular set of social arrangements that tends to privilege straight, white, conservative male voices.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that Christian nationalism doesn't mean that, you know, if we have Christian nationalism in our country, it doesn't mean that then all the Christians get to rule and have privileges, right? It's actually only a narrow slice of Christianity. And Rob, I know you know this well. I mean, you've received a lot of criticism and pushback for your public ministry from people espousing Christian nationalism. It's the same thing we see in Russia today. It's a Christian nationalist state. The Russian Orthodox Church and Putin's regime are hand in hand, and yet they're also persecuting other Christians. Baptists are the second most persecuted group in Russia after Jehovah's Witnesses. Pentecostals are third, right? And so only a narrow slice of Christianity actually gets all of the power and privilege if Christian nationalism wins.
Well, and I think too, one of the things that I struggle with Christian nationalism is there has to be a difference between civil religion, which isn't inherently on its face a bad thing, and you talk about this again. You do such a masterful job of this in your book. There is a difference between civil religion, what we do as a community in a religious sphere, and that of Christian nationalism. But sometimes the lines get a little blurred, as we saw in the book that you talk about. There are moments where it seems like these politicians and these political types, or even just regular citizens, are flat using religion as a club over the head rather than a balm for a weary soul. And so I hope you might talk a little bit about the difference between civil religion, what we do as a public, and this Christian nationalism vein that is kind of being pernicious in our current society.
Yeah, so I need to get in here before Brian says I told you so. You know, the two of us writing together, we just share a lot of conversations, and over the years, I've been the one who's been more of a defender of, you know, civil religion has a place. We need a place where we have sort of a sense of transcendence as a nation. We have a public sort of rituals that sort of point to our shared belief systems, that kind of a thing. But what we're seeing more and more is civil religion and Christian nationalism are really blurring together, and one almost becomes a gateway for the other. In a way that makes it hard to sort of say, like, geez, the road over here really leads you to a pretty negative place. Because what we've seen is a lot of the things that we thought were fine and good, a lot of things that we thought were just more civil religion, you know, under God, it's very vague. What do we even mean by God there, right? It does not, we're not defining the deity in that phrase in a way that seeks to exclude too many people. Well, in reality, it does, but we can get to that. But the point is, a lot of that is now what people are pointing to as Christian nationalism. See, we are a Christian nation. We have the word under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. So Well, I think I've become a little more critical of the idea of civil religion in terms of both really thinking it has substance as to what it is and what it isn't, and also to kind of what it has wrought within our society. And I will confess, Brian's been there a lot longer than I have, so now I'll let him say, I told you so.
Like I said, I don't have to say it if you say it. But I do think, Robert, I think there's two really important things about your question. And so, I mean, one of that is there is still a space for us to act in the civic square, in the public square, right? And so that is not what we're arguing. Christian nationalism is not Christians in the public space. That is something different, and it's something important to see. There's a difference though when that attempt for civil religion starts getting codified in the government. And that's when it starts moving into the realm of Christian nationalism, even more so than it was. I mean, when civil religion was developed as a concept in the 1960s by, Robert Bella, and then other scholars have picked it up, 92% of Americans profess to be Christian. So under God and, in God we trust, and this kind of language could feel quite unifying. Now, I would say it's still important that there was a small percentage of Americans that were kind of civically excommunicated as not real Americans. But broadly speaking, under God could unify the nation. It's just not true today. Only two-thirds of Americans identify as Christian. And so in our pluralistic society, we civil religion, at least in the four official government function, doesn't work. It's not unifying. It becomes Christian nationalism, and it's inherently problematic.
I think that
But
this is really important to understand just with Christianism. One of the reasons people are saying, well, this is a new term, why is it just arising now? And that's not actually true, but one of the reasons it's becoming more prominent and we're growing into awareness of it now is because our society is becoming less homogenous. And as our society becomes more diverse, more pluralistic, we're realizing we're going to have to work harder at living together despite our disagreements about really big things. And unfortunately, there's one group of people that really wants to doesn't want to engage that project. They want to force their beliefs on everyone else, and they want to use the government to do it.
well, it's so interesting in your book, even when you get to the subtitle, I'm okay with baptizing America to a point. That's a good title. But then you say how mainline Protestants help build Christian nat I mean, like, you're saying that I, as a frozen member of the frozen chosen, is implicated in the Christian nationalism that I see on TV on January 6th, when I see these people raising their Christian flags and waving them at Trump rallies. I'm a part of that as a mainline Christian. I thought I was doing the right thing, the progressive thing, the socially acceptable thing, and you're telling me that I'm not in this book. Is that correct, or am I off on that?
No, you're spot on, Rob. I'm right there with you. I'm a mainline Protestant pastor myself. I love the mainline tradition. Brian and I have been talking for a couple of years about a lot of this stuff that we were labeling Christian nationalism had origins in the mainline church and were continued to be perpetuated by the mainline church. Again, how did we get under God in the Pledge of Allegiance? It came from the mainliners. And unfortunately, that's a we haven't interrogated that past, and we haven't seen the ways we've contributed to this problem. So Brian and I wrote a piece for Religion and Politics, came out a year ago, January, just as a kind of a trial balloon. Let's see what people think of this argument. Are we missing something? Let's let the historians and the sociologists and the theologians kind of pick at our argument and see what we're wrong about. And so we wrote that piece, and we got a lot of great feedback from them and from the mainline leaders saying, this needs to be said. This is spot on. And that's what caused us to write the expanded book. And then, yeah, if you, you know, if for those who are going to be getting the book, there's a couple of endorsements that really speak to this. And one, it comes from Will Willimon, one of the things where he says, this book has caused this mainliner to take a sober theological assessment of my church and its unknowing complicity in the nascence of ugly Christian nationalism. I have met the syncretistic, idolatrous, confused nationalist. It turns out that he looks like the nice, middle-of-the-road, moderate Methodist me. Oops. And I just love that endorsement because it does speak to, frankly, the conviction that I feel and that I think a lot of people will feel after they read this book if they're part of the mainline tradition.
Yeah, we joked a lot while we were writing that we were going to make all of our friends upset with this book. But there is something cathartic, right, about pointing at the white conservative evangelicals and be like, look at them, look how bad they are. Thank God I'm not one of them, right? Type of
Almost
almost
sounds
Jesus
biblical there when
parable.
you said that.
Right. And then yet they're when you actually look at it, like there's Christian nationalism in the various mainline traditions. And, particularly in the past, but we unpack even some ways that it's still there in the present. And it might be a softer, cuddlier, friendlier version. It's not quite a storm the Capitol and, attack police officers version of Christian nationalism. But that doesn't mean it's not unhealthy. That doesn't mean it's not still a problem for democracy, and even more importantly, a problem to our faith. It distorts the Christian witness. And so if we really want to tackle Christian nationalism, I think we have to figure out how we got here. That it's not a Trumpian problem. It's not just an evangelical problem. We need to get to the roots of it.
We see a generational shift too in thinking about patriotism and its role in the American life and experiment and how we participate in public and civic discourse and even civic religion. I remember, my church in North Carolina was one of the first really during the Iraq War to think about removing the American flags as a symbol of patriotism, but also, we weren't going to, say the Pledge of Allegiance on July 4th, the Sunday closest to July 4th. And that never bothered me. It wasn't something that really got in my crawl the way it did other people in my church who were much older than me or had much more life experience than me. And I don't want to make this an ageist question, but does that say something about the old guard and this new generation coming up? Or is this just me being too damn young to understand why there's a problem with the flags going out of the sanctuary?
So my favorite pitch to tell people why they need to buy this book is that this book will tell you how to talk about the flag in the sanctuary and give you productive ways of addressing it that won't get you fired as a pastor or divided as a congregation. I really believe that. And I think part of that starts talking about why the flag's there to begin with, right? And we go into some of this history. That flag was brought in at a time when to be American and to be Christian was not to be, communistic and atheistic. And so you have a bunch of people who were told, bring that flag into the sanctuary, that's virtuous. And now that generation is hearing, no, this is no longer virtuous. And you can understand why they're struggling with that. But I think, again, it starts with what is going on in the sanctuary when we gather for worship? What is the purpose of our worship? And why is that flag there? What is it symbolizing? And why do we feel like it's so important to have it in that space, given what we're doing there for worship? I think there's a lot to unpack there. And our book really aims to help people do that in a way that, again, can actually help churches become more Christian, not more divided over the flag.
One of the things that I think that your book left me wondering, and I think you do a good job of addressing this, but I hope you might speak to it now. In my own life, I've had to kind of gain a deeper perspective of what it means to have a patriotic sense or a love for my country despite its flaws. Despite our own misgivings, our own horrible past and current realities, the atrocities both present and former. In my own life, I've actually grown a little more patriotic as I've gotten more involved in addressing Christian nationalism. Like, how dare they try to take this stuff from me? How dare they try to make Christianity into something that represents the best ideals of this country when it's really the worst ideals of this country. It's our worst angels, not our better angels, right? So I'm curious, can a Christian be patriotic in this day and age, and how do we do that effectively?
So I'm like you, Rob. I love the United States of America. I love living in this country. I wouldn't want to live anywhere else. I appreciate all the freedoms it gives us, including the freedoms to worship, right? And the freedom for me to do ministry. And there's a lot of places around the world where being the pastor of a Christian community would be a lot more difficult because of the way the state restricts and even persecutes pastors and churches and Christians. At the same time, I don't want to be lighting off fireworks in the sanctuary. One, it might burn my church down and my insurance company would be pretty upset. More importantly, I think it conflates what we're worshiping, right? And so for me, the argument about we can be patriotic without having to steal our book title, without having to baptize America, right? We can celebrate all that's good about America. We can remind ourselves of its ideals. We can even critique it and challenge it to live up to those ideals, which is a very patriotic thing, without meaning to make it sacred to the point of idolatry where we can't critique it or we can't name the places it's fallen short because it's become this god that is seen as infallible. And I think that's the danger of Christian nationalism. And frankly, that's the danger even of some civil religion is making the country into something that is transcendent in a way that raises it up inappropriately and frankly diminishes God and the church in a way that's sacrilegious to the Christian faith.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we have, as you noted, Robin, we have a lot of past sins that our country has to grapple with, and from slavery and Native American genocide, and we're far from perfect. And there's also good angels from our past that we can lift up. And one of those is the separation of church and state. I mean, this was a unique American experiment, and it works. It's good for the country. It's good for the churches. It's why religion flourished in the Americas because of the separation of church and state, first in, flourishing some of the colonial period, and then in the United States. We see a much different relationship with religion in our country than in most other Western European nations, where they were marrying church and state. And so, I mean, that's part of what the things we can be proud of. And as we make the argument in the book, we think democracy is itself a good. True democracy that brings in an equal voice, an equal say, that everyone is treated as an equal citizen. And we don't need to stamp God on that or make some sort of Christian nation to make America worth, defending and participating in. Democracy in and of itself is something worth lifting up. And we think that that's important. So we can be patriotic and excited about that without being nationalistic.
One of the things that I'm acutely aware of is we're almost at the time of this recording of this podcast, we are nearly 6 months away from the presidential election that
We have
may
that
be.
long to go still.
I know
Oh.
it's a slog. This is probably one of it has to be one of the most consequential elections. And I know we say that every time, but this one feels like it's really like this one's the one, this is a decision point for a lot of us about how we're going to enact. Maybe our faith, like where does our faith lie? Does it lie in these principalities and powers that are here, or do we trust that God is doing something? And how do we enact God's reign here on earth as it is in heaven? I mean, this is real kingdom work here. I mean, I think this fight for our own ability to be the people who God has called us to be, not at arms with others, but actually in peace and cohabitation throughout this land. That's real stuff for me, and it's really important for me. And so on one hand, we've got this man selling a Bible that is truly, just I can't wrap my head around that. First of all, the price, and then, on top of that, the Lee Greenwood connection and all this. I mean, it boggles the mind. Then you've got a man who I know personally, who've gotten to know with my work, and who has a quiet faith and a quiet resolve about himself. And look, I'm not, I know where I stand, and I'm not asking you to endorse a candidate on a podcast, but I am asking, how can Christians who are participating in civic life, not as Christian nationalists, but as well-meaning citizens of this country, participate well in what's to come, whatever they decide to vote for.
So for me, this whole conversation starts with my theology of what do I think God desires for the world, right? I think God desires a world where everyone can flourish. And so what I look at when I vote, whether it's for the city council or the president of the United States, is who are the candidates that are going to do the things that promotes the flourishing of the most people and that respects the dignity of all people so that they can flourish as God desires. And back to what Brian was saying about democracy, right? As a Christian, one of the reasons I want to defend democracy is not so that I can use majority power to enforce Christianity, but because I think democracy allows everybody to have a say and it allows for the most people to flourish. So my defense of democracy is certainly rooted in my Christian faith, even as I'm trying to create a space where everybody can live as they desire, as they want in a democratic society. So when I'm looking at this presidential election, those are the things in my mind is how do we defend democracy in a way that, protects the rights of people to have a say in their government, and how who can I vote for that's going to make sure the most people can flourish and not just privilege a small group of people who want to, again, control society and in some sense take it back to a bygone era that was not nearly as exciting and prosperous as they might imagine it to be in their nostalgia.
Yeah, I've never been a single issue voter, but I'm about as close as I've ever been, and that issue being democracy. And I think it's really important that it is the best system. It's what protects our rights, our individual rights. When truly implemented. And I mean, I think it's important to realize that democracy is still a new experiment in the United States. I mean, we've really only been a democracy since like 1965. I mean, we're not talking about something that we've actually done for centuries. You know, it's not until everyone has the right to vote that we really actually start to live into, you know, the ideas of a democracy. And so it's still very fragile. And I cannot support or vote for a candidate of any party who doesn't believe in democracy, that wants to remove and end democracy. So that to me is a significant dividing line in this election cycle and this political environment, more than we see in most cycles and more elections. I think that's really important. And as far as like the faith issue, I think it's also important to note that, I mean, I'm a strong believer in Article 6 of the United States Constitution. There should be no religious test for office. And I mean, we don't have an official one, although sometimes we act like we kind of have an unofficial one that we want to impose. And I don't care if the candidate is a Christian or not. But I do care about values. I care about character, right? Are they trustworthy? Are they going to tell us what they actually think? Are they going to try to live out their campaign promises, right? Or are they just going to lie to us all of the time? Like, character matters. And that used to make me a conservative when I said that as a teenager, and now somehow that makes me a liberal. So, anyways, I don't know how that works, but character matters, whether it's a, you know, a religious person or not. And but we see with Christian nationalism, what they want to do is because they believe we're supposed to be a Christian nation, then when their preferred candidate doesn't necessarily line up with that, then they have to redefine everything, right? So now somehow this man is the Christian, and the others aren't. And we can see that that just doesn't match with the basic biblical values. It doesn't match with basic character values. So I think that's where we're both coming from on this idea of how do we live into this? But it's going to be, I mean, I'm fortunate I'm not a pastor this year. I mean, I'll do some guest preaching. That's fine. But this is going to be a tough, difficult year for pastors like Bo across the country because all of the division and partisanship in our society. It's gonna be crammed into the churches, whether the pastors want it there or not.
You know, one of the things that concerns me most about Christian nationalism, and we can leave it here with your final thoughts about this, maybe, is that one of my best friends is a representative in the Georgia State Legislature, Representative Rua Roman, who is the first Palestinian American elected to the state legislature in the state of Georgia. I met her 10 years ago on the campus of Emory University, which at the time of this recording again is in the news over some protests about Palestine and how that's all enacted. And what I can't help but see, guys, and this is what scares me about Christian nationalism. It won't affect me. I'll in some ways I'll be good. Like I can pass as a Christian nationalist if push came to shove. Because I'm a white dude, I'm a white cisgender male. But I look at my friend Rua in her headscarf, and I see my other friends of color and my friends who are women or in the transgender community, and I think to myself, gosh, this is not about me anymore. This is about so much more than just this self-actualization and realization, right? Like this isn't about us. We're a bunch of white dudes. We, you know, we'd be good in some ways. And yet it is incumbent upon us, as you have done, to write the book, to write the damn book and say, this is what it's about, and this is the problem that we're facing, right? I mean, this is putting the rubber to the road of it all, right?
Yeah, I think that if there's a silver lining to this conversation we're having on the dangers of Christian nationalism and its rising intensity in our society, it's that this is also a moment for us to think about what we want to be. This is a chance for us to be the democracy and the society we claim to be, to live into our ideals where of equality and liberty and respect for everybody, and figuring out how to live together despite the diversity among us, or and appreciate the diversity among us. And it's also a chance for the church to be the church, right? To be who we are on our own, and not looking for the government to legitimate us or privilege us, but to just be the church of Jesus Christ and be witnesses to the gospel in a way that isn't coercive, but is, again, about seeking the flourishing of all those who God loves. And so my hope is that our book and this broader conversation will end up being constructive in our society, because it will help us be a better church, and it will help us be a better country.
Yeah, one of our goals for this book is, as we unpack some of the history and present in the mainline tradition, we're also hoping that mainline Protestants, clergy, lay leaders will lead the effort to kind of detox from Christian nationalism. This is the group of Christians that we think can actually make a significant difference. You know, there are too many preachers that are promoting Christian nationalism. Greg Locke, Franklin Graham, Robert Jeffress, right? They're not going to change. At least they're not going to listen to us. I mean, hopefully God can speak on their heart and they can repent, right? And see the way. But they're not going to read our book, and they're not going to listen to us if we tell them that Christian nationalism is a problem. But there are a lot of moderate and progressive Christians that can do the difficult work of separating the wheat and the chaff in their own churches, in their own denominations, and that will have an impact on the broader society. And so that's what we really hope will come out of this. Let's do the work to, you know, maybe we can't change who's president. Maybe we can't change Congress. Speaker Mike Johnson isn't going to answer any of our phone calls. But we can all, in our own environment, do something to put forth the global gospel message of Jesus and to push out Christian nationalism.
The task looms large before us, right? The old hymn goes. I think that's true for this. The book is Baptizing America: How Mainline Protestants Help Build Christian Nationalism. It's out in June, wherever books are sold, and I hope you guys will pick up a copy. Brian and Bo have been true allies to me in my work, but also good friends in their work too. I've gotten to participate in some of what they've done. And so I'm grateful for you too. I'm grateful for this book. It is a good book. It's really well done. And I am so appreciative of this message, of this reminder, not only of our ability to be complicit, but our ability to change and to be better. So thank you both for coming on Beloved Journal.
Thanks,
Thanks,
Rob.
Rob. And I should just mention for your listeners, because our publisher would want them to know this, that if they order directly from chalicepress.com, they can use a promo code BA Podcast for Baptizing America Podcast and get a third off the cover price of the book.
There you go. And we'll link that in the notes. Thanks, guys.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Beloved Journal is a podcast on a mission. Check out our other episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Today's podcast was hosted by the Reverend Rob Lee. Find him on Twitter at RobLee4 or on Instagram at RevRobLee. You can find our social media on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter by searching for Beloved Journal and finding our logo. Beloved Journal's theme music is a cover of the Golden Girls theme song done by Mipsa. Seriously, they're the best band in the world. This podcast was the dream of Stephanie Lee and was produced by Maggie the Golden Doodle and Frank the Poop. Go show the world that it's worth fighting for. And as always, thanks for listening.